Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. So much to get to on yet another smoky Monday morning, one in a long string of bad air days for California and the rest of the West, and experts say we can expect this into next month. Massive, record-setting wildfires are to blame, of course. President Donald Trump is on his way to Sacramento this morning to meet with fire officials and Governor Newsom. We'll have more on that in just a moment. Later this hour, we'll look at how both fire and the pandemic are transforming where we live in California and northern Nevada. COVID-19 has sped up changes and exacerbated issues like economic inequality and remote work. It seems to be here to stay, right? Giving some people a bit of flexibility on where to live. What does that mean for cities? And what does it mean for rural areas? But first, let's get an update on the wildfires burning all over the West. Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey says two more people have been confirmed dead from the fires, bringing the state's total wildfire death count to 24 this year. Honey says 7 people remain missing. The National Weather Service issued a red flag warning for the area today through tonight. Strong southerly winds and low humidity are expected to elevate fire weather conditions throughout the region. Conditions may improve a little bit tomorrow, but not a lot. And then there's this. The incident meteorologist says the air quality, as I mentioned, in the region may not improve until October. Let's pull in Cap Radio's politics reporter Nicole Nixon, who is covering the president's visit today. He's here for a wildfire update. It's his first time to Northern California since the Camp wildfire in Butte County nearly 2 years ago, and I believe his first time in Sacramento County as president. Nicole, what is expected during today's visit?
Well, we know that Trump will get here just before 11 a.m. Is when he's scheduled to arrive, and he'll have a private briefing with local and federal emergency and fire officials. Governor Gavin Newsom will be in that briefing as well. Not sure yet whether Trump will say anything afterward before he departs. He does have another campaign stop in Arizona this afternoon, so it will be a pretty brief visit.
And this all came about relatively quickly, so of course the press has to scramble to get there and that sort of thing and get approved to go in. Do we know yet whether there will be press availability? I know you were mentioning that we're not sure whether the president will say anything afterwards, but perhaps the governor, or will there be some press interaction of some sort?
I mean, we hope so. We think that the president coming here would say something about, you know, the people that have lost their lives and their homes during these devastating wildfires. Mm-hmm. I am just waiting to get in here, and there's a very large crowd already gathered outside in support of the president, I should note, too.
You're at McClellan Air Force Base currently?
Yes. I haven't entered the press parking lot yet, but and just outside it.
Ahead of today's visit, the governors of California, Oregon, and Washington state, all states that are seeing massive wildfires right now, have said that those fires are a consequence of climate change. The president has blamed poor forest management for the flames that have killed, well, at least 35 people, destroyed neighborhoods, and enveloped the West Coast in that smoke that we've all been choking on for weeks now. We should note that fires are burning on National Forest Service lands, which are not controlled by the states, but by the Trump administration. Numerous studies in recent years have linked bigger wildfires to global warming from the burning of coal, oil, and gas. Governor Newsom released a video on Friday where he rips into climate change deniers.
When you have temperatures, record-breaking temperatures, record droughts, then you've got something else at play. And that's exactly what the scientists have been predicting for a half a century. It is here now. California, folks, is America fast forward. What we're experiencing right here is coming to a community all across the United States, America, unless we get our act together on climate change.
So, Nicole, the president and the governor of California clearly disagree on this issue, but there are some areas where they also come together. How is this expected to play out today?
Well, I think that will be really interesting, and I'm definitely watching what each president and the governor say after their meeting. I think It's interesting that Newsom will be leaving to go survey another fire site on his own. But the fact that Trump does not talk about climate change very often, he doesn't say that it's human caused, especially in the very vocal and urgent way that Governor Newsom has spoken about it in the past, but particularly in the last few weeks as these fires have sparked and grown so rapidly in this dried out state.
A couple of years ago, or nearly a couple of years ago, there was a famous photo taken of several famous photos taken of the governor and the president together in Butte County. They seem to have a pretty good meeting that time.
Yeah, and you know, I'll say that Newsom has not played politics as usual with Trump for most of this year. You know, as the coronavirus has raged, I've done some reporting on this, that Newsom has sort of put politics aside and realized that if he wants any help from the federal government, he has to kind of play nice with President Trump because he responds to that. And so, you know, when the president has delivered things like sending 100,000 test kits to California earlier this summer, Newsom was very praiseworthy of the president. Now, the flip side of that is that Newsom has ended up in Trump campaign ads when he does make those sort of flattering statements about the president. Mm. And less than 2 months before an election, I think Newsom is going to have to be very careful about the way he responds to Trump showing up here last minute and the way he responds to any sort of help that the president may offer. He's already signed some emergency declarations that free up FEMA money for the state and for people who've been affected by the fires. But I think he's going to want to be very careful about appearing in any campaign ads so close to the election.
Yeah, Nicole, there was a period, I believe it was this past spring, and as I remember it, you and I were in the studio and we were hosting one of those statewide Governor Newsom press conferences. And I remember Governor Newsom saying, in regards to aid and masks being sent to the state from the federal government, from the Trump administration, that Governor Newsom said, promises made, promises kept. And then during the Republican National Convention, I heard that phrasing. I did not see a clip from Governor Newsom, but I was just waiting. When he said it at the time, as I recall it, you and I looked at each other and said, that'll be a campaign ad.
Oh, yeah. And it did appear in a campaign ad actually later that same day that he said it. And promises made, promises kept has been a campaign slogan of Trump since earlier this year or even last year, I believe.
Nicole, since we have you here and we're not exactly sure, you know, what the president will be saying today, can we take a quick look at some of the bills Governor Newsom signed into law heading into the weekend?
Yeah, I think the big one is this SB 45 bill. We can just touch on this briefly.
145?
SB 145. So this is a very controversial bill. There's a lot of misinformation about this bill. Opponents have billed it as a pro-pedophilia piece of legislation, and it is not that at all. It's meant to address the way that LGBTQ teens and young people are treated with consensual sex on the sex offender registry. So people are saying that it legalizes sex between minors and people up to 10 years their senior. That is not true at all. It does not change the way sex crimes are prosecuted. It does not change the statute of limitations. It is still 18 years old in California. It just gives federal judges the same leeway to apply forcing somebody to be on the sex offender registry or not. It's up to the judge.
Because as I understand it, Nicole, prior to that, judges only had that leeway when it was heterosexual sex acts.
Yes. So this expands this to other ways of consensual sex as well.
Mm-hmm. There has been a lot of misinformation on that one. And so I'm glad that you cleared that up. That was authored by San Francisco Senator Scott Wiener.
Yeah, and he has also received death threats about this bill. And, you know, with all this awareness and campaigning against, child sex trafficking, this is in the front of mind for a lot of people that are jumping on this. And again, a lot of misinformation about this bill. Police, law enforcement groups actually has supported this bill too, because they say that it equalizes the way that people are treated under the law.
Nicole, last month on Insight, we talked a bit about how CAL FIRE is in a little bit of a pinch this year because inmates are unable to help fight on the front lines because of the pandemic. As I understand it, the governor signed a bill that would now make it easier for inmate firefighters to become professional firefighters after they're released?
Yes, this has been a huge issue in California, and it's gotten a lot of attention the last few years as these fires have raged during fire season. And he actually signed this bill on Friday at a fire site at this like smoked out forest. It will let people, inmate fire crews who are paid, you know, dollars a day to risk their lives and fight fires, allow them to have their records expunged. If they're nonviolent, you know, there are certain inmates who would still not be eligible for this, but so that they can't, so it clears the way so that they can fight fires professionally after they're released from prison, which it widely cheered. I haven't seen any opposition to this bill. Well, a little bit.
There's always
not right. A lot.
Nicole, in the last minute here, either what else has he signed, or what are people waiting on him to sign? Where do things stand in Sacramento right now?
So he does have just a couple more weeks left in the signing period, and it's hundreds of bills still to get through on his desk. One that he did sign is this AB5 cleanup bill, which adds a few more independent contractor type positions exempted from AB5, you know, freelance journalists were some of them. There were room for musicians as well to be cleared from that. So that was a big one as well.
Mm-hmm. AB5, that a lot of people think of it as like the Lyft and Uber bill. And then, of course, we have that coming up on the ballot as well.
Absolutely.
All right. Nicole Nixon, Cap Radio's politics reporter at McClellan Air Force Base this morning, waiting for President Donald Trump to visit Sacramento County for the first time in his presidency. Nicole, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And up next, how COVID-19 and the wildfires are changing where we live and how we live and what life will look like in the years and decades to come. A reminder that you can reach out to Insight via Twitter with the Ask Insight hashtag. Also, I'm at Randall White, and the show is at Cap Radio Insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our focus today is how COVID-19 and the historic wildfires we're experiencing are changing where we live and how we live and what life may look like in the years and decades to come. The pandemic is transforming, for sure, urban life. COVID-19 has sped up changes and, in some cases, exacerbated issues like economic inequality that have been brewing for years in cities throughout the country. Remote work, it's here to stay, giving some people, anyway, the flexibility to leave big cities and head to distant suburbs and more affordable rural areas. In fact, we've seen a large influx of people moving from the Bay Area to Sacramento for affordability reasons for years, and that appears to be holding up during the pandemic. Bill Fulton is the director of the Kinder Institute for Urban Research at Rice University. He's also the editor and publisher of the California Planning and Development Report. He's a former mayor of Ventura and director of planning and economic development for San Diego. He's also the author of several books, including The Guide to California Planning. And Bill Fulton joins us now. Welcome to Insight, Bill.
Thank you.
You wrote in March that COVID-19 will accelerate changes that have been brewing in cities for a long time. First, when we say cities, how big of a city are we talking about?
Well, Sacramento is certainly big enough. I think any city over 100,000 people that has a variety of activities in it, you know, jobs, housing, retail, they're all going to be affected by it.
And what are some of the changes you're talking about when you say accelerate changes?
Well, I think there's a couple things. The most obvious thing that's going to be accelerated is the decline of bricks and mortar retail stores and the increase in online shopping. And you know, everybody's neighborhood is clogged with Amazon delivery trucks right now.
Right.
What that means, of course, though, is that your neighborhood shopping center will have a lot more holes in it than it does now. And it'll take a long time for the people in the real estate industry to figure out what to do with all that space. The big unknown is how much is this remote work going to stick? Are people really going to work at home a lot of the time or most of the time? I think we're going to see more people work at home more of the time. And then what does that do to commuting patterns? Does that actually make it easier to get to work in the morning, or do people start going back to work? The retail part of it is very certain. The remote work and the impact on commuting and on office space is very uncertain.
Bill, over the past decade, we saw this migration from the suburbs to the inner core of many cities, including Sacramento. Sacramento's downtown and midtown have really had this renaissance over the last several years. New restaurants coming in, just a vibrancy. People wanted to be able to live where they could either catch transit or walk to work, and then be able to step out their door and not have to travel too far on foot or on bike to get to a restaurant or a bookstore, cafe, whatever. That's changing, is it not? what might the inner cities look like?
Well, I agree that I love downtown and midtown Sacramento. They are great places and much better places than they were 10 or 15 years ago. A lot of people are assuming that if you don't have to commute to work, you're not going to want to live in a close-in neighborhood. You're going to want to move as far out as you can into the suburbs. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think a lot of people will do that. But I think what it frees people up to do is to live in the place they want to live and live the lifestyle they want to live. And for some people, that is in the suburbs. But for some people, living in downtown or midtown Sacramento is not just proximity to your job. It's a lifestyle choice. At our annual survey at the Kinder Institute, which is not about Sacramento, it's about Houston, we find year after year when we ask people what kind of life do you want to live, an urban or a suburban life, it's split about half and half, and that hasn't changed in many years. And so I think the lifestyle choice part of living downtown midtown is not going to change.
I apologize earlier. I was introducing you. I called it the Kinder Institute, which sounds nice, right? but it's Kinder. Okay.
That's correct.
Good to know. Some jobs really just lend themselves to this stay at home type of thing, compared to others. Are we seeing more of those types of jobs, or what are you expecting to see moving forward?
Yeah, I think that the difference will be that when people are just sitting in front of their computer typing, they're probably not going to need to go to the office, assuming they have a hospitable environment to do that at home, which some people do and some people don't. But when you have to have meetings and face-to-face interaction, then you're going to have to be in a central location, right? Imagine, just look how much difficulty the legislature had before the session ended. And imagine lobbyists trying to do their job, you know, remotely. That's pressing the flesh is hard to do by Zoom. So I think what you're going to see is these urban centers, such as downtown Sacramento, are going to become centers of face-to-face interaction, not just places where people go to sit at a computer and type.
Bill, I wonder about convention centers. So many conventions have popped online this year, and Sacramento's in the midst of a massive renovation of its convention center. Where a convention center goes has always been important in city planning. It's a source of tourism and bringing some vibrancy to areas of the city. What do you foresee along those lines? you know, there are, sure, you can certainly hold conventions online in a Zoom style type of thing, but some of those after convention get togethers are where some of the real deals are made, right?
Well, you know, ironically enough, the urban planners of California are right now starting their virtual conference. It was supposed to be in Riverside, and now it's virtual. And tomorrow night is the online opening reception. I just can't imagine how you schmooze at such an event, right? Because I've been schmoozing at that event for many years. And there's been a lot of evidence that people like like if I'm giving a lecture or something, you can get a much bigger audience from all over the place. And I think that's going to stick. But again, as with face-to-face interaction with lobbyists and so forth, this face-to-face contact that occurs at conferences in professional and trade associations, I think that's going to become even more valuable and even more valued in the future. So I expect to see that'll come back.
Sometimes when people are looking for a place to live, they'll look up the walkability score of a neighborhood.
Right, the walk score,
right. And you say that post-pandemic, more people, or current pandemic, I guess, more people in the U.S. will be walking, but not all areas are walkable though, right? So
right.
What are cities doing about that?
Well, that's a good question. Many, many cities have, of course, such as Oakland, for example, have closed some streets, and many more cities have opened up for outdoor dining and so forth, allowed restaurants to go into parking lots and parking spaces. And that changes the walking environment for the better. So I would I think people are liking, particularly in California, being outdoors more in their activities, and I expect that to stick. So I think you will see some permanent change where streets that are now fast moving will become slower and narrower in order to accommodate outdoor activities such as dining, and that'll be good for walking.
And Sacramento Mayor Steinberg was here on Insight recently saying that several streets in Sacramento will shift to this slow street model that have been taken up by other cities. Finally, Bill, if you could, in just about a minute, a new NPR Harvard poll of the pandemic's financial toll on America's four largest cities, including L.A., of course, shows half of all households are in serious financial distress. So how do these big cities deal with that when you have that large of a chunk of the population that's just not doing well?
Boy, I don't know. I live in a big city, Houston, which was in that study, and mm-hmm. It was found that 63% of the households in Houston were affected by that. That's not something that can be overcome, I think, by local action. If you had Mayor Steinberg on this panel, on this show right now, he'd probably tell you that they need help. I don't see without additional stimulus in the short run from the federal government, those cities and their residents are going to survive. That's going to be a big blow.
All right. Bill Fulton is the director of the Kinder Institute for Urban Research at Rice University. He's also the editor and publisher of the California Planning and Development Report. Bill, thank you so much. Now get to your conference.
Thank you.
All right. Let's turn to the housing market. We're seeing people leave bigger cities for the suburbs and smaller areas. For instance, in Truckee, you know, near Lake Tahoe, the housing market there has been booming during the pandemic. It's up more than 23% since just last year. Truckee is part of a trend that realtors and journalists are calling Zoom towns, places that are booming as remote work becomes the norm. It's a trend that Zillow economist Jeff Tucker has been following, and he joins us now with a little bit more. Hey, Jeff, nice to have you back on Insight.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So the term Zoom towns, I'm sure the company Zoom is thrilled about that, are places that are booming as remote work becomes the norm. What kind of places are people moving specifically?
Well, you already mentioned Truckee, and of course the towns around Lake Tahoe are very popular destinations for this. And on the East Coast, it's a lot of sort of vacation destination towns. So the Catskills in the Hudson Valley, Long Island and Cape Cod, all of these places are seeing a huge boom in demand. And I think part of the story in these places is obviously they have wonderful natural amenities. That's why people were already going to them as vacation destinations. And frankly, this is for a segment of the housing market, a segment of the American public who might be able to afford to just keep a second home. If, you know, if we all get called back to the office next year, things start to go back to normal, it would still be nice to have an extra house on Lake Tahoe or in the Hamptons. Obviously, this is not something that, say, the majority of Americans have gone out and bought a house on Lake Tahoe. But for the folks with the financial resources to do so, they are especially interested right now. And we're seeing that demand sort of continue way into autumn beyond the kind of typical summer vacation season.
Yeah, there's apparently enough people with resources to push those numbers up the way they have, like in the Truckee region. I mean, how many times have we all been on vacation and you think to yourself, or you say out loud, you know, to the person you're traveling with, if we could just live here, like, wouldn't that be great? But we got to go back to work. And in today's day and age, work could be in your living room.
Right. Mm-hmm. Many people are working from home, especially in the Bay Area. The employers there are some of the most work from anywhere friendly in the country. I think what's going to start to hold more people back, the sort of limits of that, is that, you know, people are thinking about their neighborhood. They're thinking about their friends or their kids' friends, who their kids are in school with. Most people are not simply, you know, commuting and only tied to a location by their commute. They're also tied by their friends and family networks, which are a really important part of any city you live in. And I think this period of only connecting to so many of our friends and family via Zoom, like we're doing right now,
right.
is making a lot of people really appreciate and look forward to getting back to a lot of those face-to-face interactions. So I there may be a really pent-up appetite for that kind of face-to-face interaction that you get in your neighborhood, in which takes a fairly large, fairly dense city to actually get that concentration of connections for your own family nearby. So I think that's why there may be some limit to this interest in just sort of scattering to the winds and into the little mountain towns of the country.
Right. And certainly with all the wildfires that are going on right now in these, what do they call it? Wildland Urban Interface, or WUIs, I think is WUIs. It creates its own set of problems if they start expanding these cities like the Truckees and such.
Yeah, certainly. Out here on the West Coast, we are all now up here in Seattle. I'm breathing the same smoke that folks are in Sacramento right now. I think we're all coming to appreciate more just the risks of building further and further out into the forests, and, you know, the risks that come with recreation. But also just that with climate change, I'm afraid that summers like this are going to become more and more normal. So that's certainly a factor in people's decisions. Unfortunately, right now, clearly being in the big cities is no guarantee that you avoid the smoke as well.
Jeff, you said recently that we're seeing about a third, fewer homes that are listed compared to this time last year. Why is there a major shortage of homes on the market?
Yeah, this is the big story driving the housing market this summer. Has been a historic shortage of homes available. Demand, as an economist, I turn to demand and supply. Demand is strong, partially due to record low mortgage rates. They went under 2.9% last week. So a lot of renters out there are thinking, hey, this is a good time to buy. My monthly payment will go a lot further right now. And sure, I'm shopping in a pandemic, but I could lock in a low rate for the next 30 years. And there was already a big pool of people considering that. There's this just record bumper crop of young 30-somethings. This is the heart of the millennial generation, is right at the age where Americans try to move into homeownership. So they are kind of forging ahead. Anyone whose household finances are in order and they're renting right now, they're trying to buy. And I think it's a common theme of maybe accelerating a decision people were thinking about. You know, maybe we could fit in this little apartment in the city for another couple of years. But now we're in a big hurry to get a house with a yard or an extra room for Zoom calls. So
yeah,
buyers are forging ahead and they're just not finding many listings on the market. We didn't build enough homes for the last 10 or 12 years. So that's the chickens are kind of coming home to roost on that undersupply of housing.
Right.
I'm sure it's a common refrain in California.
And for sure.
We really see that in the numbers. Say in Sacramento, it's 41% fewer homes on the market than this time last year. So
wow.
that shortage nationwide is especially acute in Sacramento.
And circumstantially, Jeff, I know some people that are moving from the Bay Area to Sacramento. They were renters in the Bay Area, but wanting to buy here for the very reasons that you just pointed out. San Francisco reportedly has a higher vacancy rate right now than some other cities its size. Is that because there's just more tech people or like tech jobs there where they can work remotely?
San Francisco is bucking this trend. It's one of the only major metro areas that actually has somewhat more inventory than this time last year, just barely. The city itself has more than double the inventory it had last year. So there are listings languishing on the market, especially in the city of San Francisco. I do think it's a combination of, frankly, being the most expensive metro area, broadly construed, if you include Silicon Valley. So the sort of payoff to moving elsewhere is very high, and it's really disproportionately employing people working in these industries. We just did a study and estimated that about 25% of renters in the Bay Area cannot afford to buy a home there, which is not surprising when they're all seven figures, but could afford to buy a home elsewhere. They're making good money and are working in a work from home friendly occupation. So we checked every metro area in the country. That was by far the highest. So that sort of work from anywhere migration potential is by far the highest in the Bay Area. And some of it is certainly headed toward the Central Valley. Some of it's certainly headed to Sacramento.
Right. Jeff Tucker is an economist with Zillow. We really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us this morning. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, always really good data information from you. Still ahead, how better city planning and transit in the wake of the pandemic can promote racial equity. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Low-income and non-white communities have been disproportionately affected nationwide during the COVID-19 pandemic. COVID-19 has shown to be deadlier for Black and Latino populations, who in particular have been found to be at greater risk because they are more likely to work at essential jobs. This makes how we get around, the safety, and the access to public transit that much more important. And Naomi Dorner is a transportation planner and equity strategist. She's the principal and director of equity, diversion, and inclusion for Nelson Nygaard Consulting Associates. Naomi joins us from Oakland, and welcome to Insight.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Randall.
Yeah, so I think many of us can wrap our brains around what a transportation planner does, but help us understand the job of an equity strategist.
Sure. So again, I work at Nelson Nygaard, based here in Oakland, and I've been a planner for about 15 years. But the work that I do as a equity strategist is really both internal as well as external. So I work a lot on process and systems change. So within my firm at Nelson Nygaard, we're a group of consultants. We work with cities across the U.S. and you know, more and more, as you noted, cities are really grappling with the implications of the policy and the planning work that they're doing in communities, specifically communities of color. And so the work that I'm doing is both supporting and building capacity of the folks we have on our team to better support our cities, and then also to work directly with cities to support their development of strategies and to really think through how they're approaching the work that they're doing, again, on policy, investments, all of these things that they're doing in cities.
So, for instance, you know, a large development wants to go in and the city has to look at it and how will the roads be laid out and how will this affect surrounding traffic and transportation routes and, you know, the light rail, all that kind of stuff. Your job is to go in there and say, have you thought about how this neighboring community might be affected by this? Because, you know, it's historically Black or Latino. This is going to cut off their access to this other thing, you know, those sorts of things, like really just give them the big picture and say, hey, have you thought about everybody?
Yeah, a lot of the work that I'm doing, I mean, just like you would have an engineer who can assess the structural sort of integrity of a bridge of some sorts, right? You have that expertise. I, in a similar vein, am working closely with cities to help them work through a series of questions that help them assess how the work that they're doing will actually impact communities, and specifically Black and Brown communities, people with mobility issues, seniors. So really thinking about it from a host of different perspectives, and also really helping them to think through how to better connect and how to build trust with communities who have, for a very long time, lived with and or without investment.
Let's talk about racial equity in transportation. This was an issue before the pandemic began, right? How has the pandemic played into that?
Well, the pandemic, as you noted when you started out, has exacerbated conditions that, you know, communities have long, as I mentioned a minute ago, have long been advocating for and or working around in the sense of not having, you know, equitable distribution of resources and investments in their communities. And so having a harder time getting around. And so when you layer a pandemic, as well as multiple other crises that are going on in our communities, especially in cities today, from climate to, you know, unrest, we know that the impacts that they're feeling as a result of, you know, reduced schedules, for instance, crowding on buses because there are less buses or things of that nature, that's having a real direct impact for folks who are still needing and having to be out to their jobs, especially essential workers. So it is exasperating and compounding, and you take into effect, I mean, not planning, but it is still overlaid. You have parents who have children who aren't necessarily in school, or if they're having to get to school, their, you know, mobility is impacted and challenged. So there's just a host of factors that are making things more difficult.
I saw this morning that BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit, will be increasing the number of trains coming up here, and a regional transit, RT here, SACRT here in the Sacramento area, is also going back to its full schedule, pre-pandemic schedule. So it's things like this that would help along those lines?
It is. It is things like this. You know, and I think in the early stages of the pandemic, you know, there was a real concern about whether transit was a vector. And I think what we're hearing and learning is that it is not the actual vector. So
for transmission of COVID-19.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For transmission of COVID-19. And so, you know, people do need and rely on these services. And I think as we're assessing we are seeing more cities restoring their service, recognizing that there are people who were impacted and maybe the original cut.
What are your thoughts on this slow streets movement that we've seen during the pandemic? Starting, I believe, there in Oakland was one of the very first cities to initiate it nationwide. And are they being put in areas where everyone has access to them equally?
I think that the original, so what's really great about these is that they've been iterative. And I think they were always kind of considered, let's test it, let's see how it goes. And with, you know, feedback and community input over time, we've seen cities amend some of the original routes. But I think originally, you know, it was sort of located in communities where, you know, you had transit and housing that were nearer to each other. Well, we know that a lot of communities of color don't necessarily live as near to transit as they would certainly like to. And so there's definitely been a reshifting and also thinking about how to bring public health services, testing sites, things of that nature. So not just making it, you know, about mobility, but also making it about public health and bringing partners to help improve some of the open open street conditions that are being put out.
Certainly, some of the headlines this past summer have focused on racial equity when it comes to policing, and that's yet another aspect of city planning and all of the, you know, operations of a city. So tell us about the importance of racial equity in city planning and police work, and how you go about giving cities that type of advice.
Yeah, I'm working with a couple as we speak. And I think, you know, the what we have to understand is that policies related to transportation, as well as housing, you know, they intersect with police enforcement, as we know, and as I think more and more people are becoming aware, with traffic stops and things of this nature. And when that happens, you know, in Black and Brown communities, it has, from an evidence-based perspective, it's really had major implications on incarceration rates and certainly on the violence, you know, perpetrated towards black folks, black men in particular, as they're seen in a threat, as they're seen as a threat. And so the what we have to understand is that our policies do interplay with traffic enforcement and enforcement. And so many cities are starting to look at how to have alternatives to policing as a kind of as a tool. And so thinking about what are restorative justice models that can be potentially implemented? What are education? How do we rely more on marketing or education tools as opposed to enforcement? And also, how do you engineer your streets better? How do you do things in a way that will limit the need for enforcement?
And when you talk about alternatives, some people might hear that as the defunding the police idea that people had put out there. It's more about shifting resources to different ways of handling those situations.
Yeah, it's putting resources where resources have been chronically under-resourced. And so ensuring that we're really looking at, you know, making sure that social services are, you know, perhaps called or, you know, resourced in a way that they could provide supports. So, yes, it's shifting things.
Yeah. Naomi Dorner is a transportation planner and equity strategist and principal and director of equity, diversion and inclusion for Nelson Nygaard Consulting Associates there in Oakland. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
With your insight, like I like to say. Thank you, Naomi. All right. You can find out more about any of the guests you heard from today here on Insight at capradio.org/insight. I'm Randall White. Producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon helped out today, especially Kyle. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. Thanks so much for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.